out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday, the 21st of January, 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. All right, yes, first off, I'd better say a big hello to any new listeners we might have. After the Mail on Sunday decided to rather irresponsibly advertise our website, our listening figures do appear to have doubled, trebled in some instances. They appear to be at the sort of levels we don't normally get for another week or so yet with our podcast. So I just hope that the new listeners are sensible people, nationalists that aren't going to be offended by our content, because we don't want to offend people. Our content is targeted at nationalists, and for any new listeners, I would advise them to check out the notice in the sidebar of the site that says important. That's kind of a mission statement for us here. That's what guides our motives for producing the content that we do. So please don't play it or show it to people that are likely to be offended, because that's a very irresponsible thing to do. And we take every reasonable step we can to avoid that from happening. Anyway, let's get into some of the news. Just before we get into some proper news stories, let's have a quick bit of movement news. I heard over the weekend that Katie Hopkins is no longer with Rebel Media. And this is something that I predicted a year or so back. I think actually on podcast with Jez Turner. And we were talking about Katie Hopkins, and I mentioned that every year she gets closer and closer to ethno-nationalism. She's moved from being a capitalist to being anti-Muslim to being a civic nationalist to presenting in rebel media. And now she is corresponding with white nationalists and helped to advertise a white nationalist conference in Finland. And of course, as soon as the rebel media hosts actually start talking to ethno-nationalists, Ezra Levant drops them like a hot potato. And of course, this has happened. So I just hope that Katie Hopkins continues to move towards ethno-nationalism. She is a very outspoken, very witty, very intelligent lady. And she can only be an asset to us. She is an asset to the white race, I believe. I also wanted to mention something about Tommy Robinson. He produced an excellent bit of propaganda at the weekend when he visited a library to question a politician about why the politician had used his parliamentary privilege in Parliament to lie about Tommy. He called him a racist, I believe, and a convicted racist or a convicted Nazi, something like this. Not true. Tommy doesn't have any convictions for those things. For being a race hater or inciting racial hatred, that was it. And he doesn't have any convictions for that. And the politician himself decided to surround the library with police so that the members of the public couldn't actually get to meet him and ask his questions, and he succeeded in looking very, very foolish. And Tommy Robinson succeeded in looking very good. And there was even somebody else that, when Tommy was explaining what had actually happened, that someone had been accused of a crime that they weren't actually guilty of by a politician, the member of the public said, "Well, yes, that's terrible." And then as soon as Tommy told him who it was, the guy ran off, and that was very funny. I've put the video in the sidebar, so if people haven't seen it, I do recommend they watch it because it is very funny. And that just shows you what good public propaganda is. And Tommy Robinson is very good at good public propaganda. I think he's doing very well with his journalism, alternative journalism. And it's great to see that we now finally have a British alternative journalist who is asking the questions that we want answers to. Okay, getting into some of the news stories. This isn't really the sort of topic that we cover, but I just thought this was so funny. This is about the Duke of Edinburgh, who's been in the news recently for his crash. And the guy is 98 years old. I mean, to be driving a car at 98, I mean, he's got to be some kind of superhero to be doing that, I think. And driving without a seatbelt on today, apparently, and the police just let him off for that. But he had a crash last week, and this was one of the news stories about it from the Telegraph. The Duke of Edinburgh's crash on Thursday was not the first he has been involved in. After the news made headlines around the world, locals reminisced about crashes and near misses that they had encountered over the decades with Prince Philip, who is a keen driver. Norfolk businessman Patrick Daines ended up in a neck brace and with whiplash injuries in January 1996 after the Prince steered his Land Rover into the back of his Mercedes 190 as he let an elderly lady across a zebra crossing. Mr. Daines said, "The Prince's Range Rover came to the back of my Mercedes while I was waiting at a pedestrian crossing. It was entirely his fault. I stopped at a pedestrian crossing to let a lady cross the road, and suddenly there was an almighty bang. My car jolted forward, and I knew immediately that it had been seriously damaged. It was then that I noticed through my rear-view mirror that it was the Duke of Edinburgh who had been driving. It was quite a surprise." At the time, royal sources confirmed the accident occurred and said the Duke apologised afterwards. Others have spoken of alleged near misses with the Duke, who locals often see driving around the area. Sue Brown claimed on social media, "Many years ago, my uncle had a similar incident around the same area. Prince Philip pulled out in front of him, but my uncle was able to stop in time. It was not until both drivers got out of their cars that my uncle realised he was shouting at the Prince, telling him to be more careful." Charlotte Tufnell, a teaching assistant from nearby Fakenham, said, "He nearly ran my dad off the road at Sandringham a few years back. He needs to pack it in." A man named Nicholas called into LBC and said that he too had been involved in a collision with Prince Philip in 1987. A biography of the Duke by Basil Boothroyd, published in 1971, notes that Prince Philip has often been accused of being a less-than-steady driver. He says, "After the engagement, there were motherly gasps from the papers. 'Philip, take it easy,' said the Sunday Pictorial. 'Lieutenant Philip hurt in car crash,' said the Daily Mail. This was to do with a skid and a twisted knee a month before the wedding to Queen Elizabeth. They got a bit sterner after the marriage, with another crash happening in February 1948, but it only dented the wing of a taxi at Hyde Park Corner, but Elizabeth was with him. 10 years later, the Daily Express was able to scrape together a total of 7 incidents in an article headlined, 'Should Philip Drive the Queen?' So just think about that. He'd already had 7 car crashes by the time he got to 1958. I wonder what people would think of back then if you were to tell them that he would still be driving his car at the age of 98. He really is quite a character. He's probably my favourite royal, the Iron Duke. Well, let's get into more of our usual content that we have here at the Daily Nationalist. I've got a new story here from Africa. Africa, one of our favourite countries to look at what's happening there. And this is something that's happening in Uganda. And apparently they've been having a bit of a problem with trouble at the local discos. A senior 3 student of Porombo Secondary School, who has been working as a part-time disc jockey in one of the disco halls in Akworo sub-county in Nebbi District, has been killed. The mob that killed Jerry Okerworth on Wednesday accused him of failing to play their favourite music. Now, if that wasn't bad enough that they've killed the DJ for playing boring music, this isn't the first time it's happened. Mr. William Bob Labija, the Nibby resident district commissioner, blamed the management of the disco hall for failing to protect the budding DJ. As the head of security in the district, I will no longer allow any disco operators to conduct their business in the sub-county, and anybody who defies the directive will be prosecuted, he said. All disco halls in all sub-counties must be closed because they are causing insecurity and redundancy among the youth. He said that over 5 people have been killed in the district in the past week. Now, is that to do with these discos? Has that been happening in these discos, that 5 people have been killed? Should the management of a disco hall be prepared to prevent the DJ from being killed when he plays? Is that the sort of thing that you expect to be happening at the local disco, that the DJ would just get shot or stabbed or macheted or whatever it was? Mr. Bosco Okawi, the Nedu sub-county chairman, said that in 2011, they passed a bylaw that stopped the issuance of licenses to disco operators in the sub-county. He said, we want all the local leaders to report those who defy the bylaw. So apparently discos are banned anyway there. And so this would have been an illegal disco that was going on where the disc jockey was shot. And this is a recent news article. This is from just from 2 days ago that this happened. So this must be a regular occurrence that they have problems with people getting killed at discos. And they must have had that for at least the last 8 years. I mean, over here in Britain, you hear of blacks driving their vehicles into nightclubs. You hear of them stabbing bouncers to death outside, but you don't often hear of them killing the DJ. Wasn't that a song by the Smiths? Hang the DJ? Hang the DJ? Anyway, I've got some reports here of how blacks used to behave, once again, from Negroes in Negroland. A compendium of reports that was entered into Congress, I believe, in America for court purposes. And I like to have a look back at that. When I hear about Negroes doing things like this today, I like to look back 150 years ago and see if there was any difference back then, because I'm firmly of the belief that they're not going to change. And whoever it is that tries to make them change fails. It's just a waste of time, because this is their natural behavior. And this is the first report that I've got from Negroes in Negroland. It was not long after my installment at Cape Mount that I accidentally witnessed the ferocity of the chief. Some trifling county affair caused me to visit the king, but upon landing at Toso, I was told he was abroad. The manner of my informant, however, satisfied me that the message was untrue, and accordingly, with the usual confidence of a white man in Africa, I searched his premises till I encountered him in the Palaver House. And I'll just stop there. Just think about that. The usual confidence of a white man in Africa. Does a white man have any confidence now in South Africa that he can go about his daily business without being mugged, robbed, or murdered? There was a time when the white man could walk about in Africa quite safely. Back then, in this time. The large enclosure was crammed with a mob of savages, all in perfect silence around the king, who in an infuriate manner, with a bloody knife in his hand and a foot on the dead body of a negro, was addressing the carcass. By his side stood a pot of hissing oil, in which the heart of his enemy was frying. My sudden and perhaps improper entrance seemed to exasperate the infidel, who, calling me to his side, knelt on the corpse and, digging it repeatedly with his knife, exclaimed with trembling passion that it was his bitterest and oldest foe. For 20 years he had butchered his people, sold his subjects, violated his daughters, slain his sons, and burned his towns. And with each charge, the savage enforced his assertion by a stab. And that was from Canoff's 20 Years of an African Slaver, page 432. So these were the boasts that the king were making, that he had violated his daughters and slain his sons. They don't think much of murdering one another. These ancient Negroes, and quite clearly, the modern Negroes don't think very much of killing one another either. This is the next quote that I've got for you. By degrees, the warriors dropped in around their chieftain. A palaver house, immediately in front of my quarters, was the general rendezvous, and scarcely a bushman appeared without the body of some maimed and bleeding victim. The mangled but living captives were tumbled on a heap in the centre, and soon every avenue to the square was crowded with exulting savages. Rum was brought forth in abundance for the chiefs. Presently, slowly approaching from a distance, I heard the drums, horns, and war bells, and in less than 15 minutes a procession of women, whose naked limbs were smeared with chalk and ochre, poured into the palaver house to join the beastly rites. Each of these devils was armed with a knife, and bore in her hand some cannibal trophy. Jenkin's wife, a corpulent wench of 45, dragged along the ground by a single limb the slimy corpse of an infant, ripped alive from its mother's womb. As her eyes met those of her husband, the two fiends yelled forth a shout of mutual joy, while the lifeless babe was tossed in the air and caught as it descended on the point of a spear. Then came the refreshments, in the shape of rum, powder, and blood, which was quaffed by the brutes till they reeled off with linked hands in a wild dance around the pile of victims. As the women leaped and sang, the men applauded and encouraged. Soon the ring was broken, and with a yell, each female leaped on the body of a wounded prisoner and commenced the final sacrifice with the mockery of lascivious embraces. In my wanderings in African forests, I have often seen the tiger pounce upon its prey, and with instinctive thirst satiates its appetite for blood and abandon the drained corpse. But these African negresses were neither as decent nor as merciful as the beast of the wilderness. Their malignant pleasure seemed to consist in the invention of tortures that would agonize but not slay. There was a devilish spell in the tragic scene that fascinated my eyes to the spot. A slow, lingering, tormenting mutilation was practiced on the living as well as on the dead, and in every instance the brutality of the women exceeded that of the men. I cannot picture the hellish joy with which they passed from body to body, digging out eyes, wrenching off lips, tearing the ears, and slicing the flesh from the quivering bones, while the queen of the harpies crept amidst the butchery, gathering the brains from each severed skull as a dainty dish for the approaching feast. After the last victim yielded his life, it did not require long to kindle a fire, produce the requisite utensils, and fill the air with the odour of human flesh. Yet before the various messes were half broiled, every mouth was tearing the delicate morsels with shouts of joy, denoting the combined satisfaction of revenge and appetite. In the midst of this appalling scene, I heard a fresh cry of exultation, as a pole was borne into the apartment, on which was impaled the living body of the conquered chieftain's wife. A hole was quickly dug, the stave planted, and faggots supplied. But before a fire could be kindled, the wretched woman was dead, so that the barbarians were defeated in their hellish scheme of burning her alive. I do not know how long these brutalities lasted, for I remember very little after this last attempt, except that the bushmen packed in plantain leaves whatever flesh was left from the orgy to be conveyed to their friends in the forest. This was the first time it had been my lot to behold the most savage development of African nature under the stimulus of war. The butchery made me sick, dizzy, paralysed. I sank on the earth benumbed with stupor, nor was I aroused until nightfall, when my crewmen bore me to the conqueror's town and negotiated our redemption for the value of 20 slaves. And that's from 20 Years of an African Slaver by Canofa, pages 384 to 386. These are eyewitness accounts of what was going on in Africa. And then we wonder, when the same sort of thing happens on the streets of London, what it is that's causing it. The thing that's causing it is the Negroes, they don't think like white people do. This sort of behaviour that you read about here, it still goes on. It goes on in Africa today. Every year you hear about restaurants that are selling human heads and human flesh, the same as these palaver shops that they're talking about here that had all the human flesh on display for people to eat. The maiming that went on recently, the maiming in Rwanda with millions of people with their arms being chopped off, beheadings, machete attacks. And then you find in London, there are people walking around on train stations with machetes. There's an old granny that gets beheaded. Drummer Lee Rigby gets beheaded. They've got this incredible knife problem there, where for every person that actually dies from being stabbed, for every one that's murdered, there are another 50 people that have been stabbed. A day doesn't go by without stabbings in London now. And there's two or three murders seem to be happening every week there. Eventually, it's just going to be like Johannesburg, if it isn't already. And finally, it will revert back to the savage behaviour that we read about in this book. That can be the only end to it if something isn't done about it now, before they get to the majority. Finally, I have a new story to do with Brexit, and I picked this one because it's interesting the way that politicians are treated differently to the rest of the nation. And this is Dan Hodges writing this for the Mail on Sunday. He says, "Last week I spoke to two distinguished Conservative MPs about what they thought would happen in the wake of the evisceration of the Prime Minister's Brexit deal by the House of Commons. One was openly opposed to Theresa May's plan, the other a reluctant but loyal supporter. 'We're on the brink of serious civil unrest,' said the rebel, gesturing to his colleagues going about their daily business in Parliament's Portcullis House. 'Look at them. They're all sitting around here like nothing's happening.' The loyalist was even more direct. 'I know what I'm doing. I'm going to go out and start stocking up on tins and loading my shotgun. I backed Brexit, and if we don't deliver it, they're going to be coming for us.'" Now, you imagine if any of the member of public was to say that they were going to be loading their shotgun in the instance that there wouldn't be a Brexit. They would be arrested for that. They'd have the terrorist police around and all sorts. But the politician can say it. And he's probably saying it just as a turn of phrase, just to show how seriously they are taking this. But they're not behaving as if they're taking it seriously. The default position is that if they can't come to a deal, if Theresa May can't come to a deal that is acceptable to them all, then on March the 29th, they need to be leaving with no deal. They need to be leaving on World Trade Organization terms. And I'm not saying they need to be doing that because I want them to be doing that. I'm saying that because that's the law. They made it into a law. When they triggered Article 50, they all signed it, 590 MPs signed this into law, that if they couldn't get to a deal, they would leave on World Trade Organization terms. And that's what they need to be doing. And the ones that are trying to overturn that are trying to say, well, we can extend Article 50, we can have another referendum, they're absolute traitors. And the ones that are even worse are the ones that are saying, we're not even going to discuss doing a deal unless you take leaving on World Trade Organization terms off the table. I mean, that threat of leaving on World Trade Organization terms, that's our bargaining chip with the European Union. That's our threat to them, is that we will leave without a deal. And then the European Union won't get its £39 billion, and the European Union won't get our trade. And don't forget that the centre of the financial services, the centre of the world's financial services, is in the City of London. The European Union will be really stuffed if we were to leave without a deal. And that is our bargaining chip. And yet you've got the Labour Party saying that needs to be taken off the table. You've got the Scottish National Party saying that needs to be taken off the table. It's absolutely ridiculous that they would be saying this. They think that the general public are all fools and don't understand what's going on. But I think most people just want them to get out and be done with it. At least if they just get out on World Trade Organization terms, it's done. They've succeeded. They've carried out the referendum result. And then the very next day, they can start doing their trade deals, doing a deal with the EU, doing everything else that they wanted to do but were unable to agree to with Theresa May's deal. But just make certain that we're actually out of the EU first. And then you've got something that can be built upon. That's the one thing that everybody agreed on, was that we were going to leave without a deal if they couldn't make one. And now they're going back on that. And really, that's the thing that brought them all together, was that was going to be the default position. And now they're just doing all they can to avoid that. That's the way out of this, is to just do that deal. Okay, 85% of them have said it's not going to be good for Britain, that we're going to lose jobs, what have you. They said all that about leaving the EU in the first place. The people that voted for it knew that we might go through a bit of a hard patch, but the benefits to the country would be so great that would be negated within a few years. Plus, then you're not going to be given the 39 billion to the EU. And the EU is going to collapse and fall apart. Anyway, Germany has just gone into recession. You've got France that's borrowing more than it can pay back. Italy that's borrowing more than it can pay back. Italy and Greece, both in recession. The EU is going to fall apart. We need to be out of it as soon as possible. And it is interesting here that this politician says that he's going to be loading his shotgun because he is expecting the general public to come for the politicians if they don't deliver it. So at least that one politician is taking it seriously. There will be civil unrest, just as there is in France, if they don't carry through on their promises, because people will have lost faith in the government. And you can hear more about that and about people losing faith in the government later on tonight in Aryan Britannia, recorded with Max Musson, where we go into every detail of the Mail on Sunday article about us that was published yesterday. If any of you were wanting to hear about that in this podcast, you can hear about it in a couple of hours' time in Aryan Britannia. And that brings us to the end of today's podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.